Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my very pleasant duty to welcome you to this, the third of a series of three lectures given by Cedric Thornberry, who needs no introduction because he has been introduced to you twice before, and I'm not going to attempt a third. But tonight is rather special for at least one reason. Cedric has caught the flu, and his voice is going. We all hope, not least Professor Mayle, who's going to read the lecture if he doesn't get through to the end, we're all hoping that it will hold out to the end, but keep your fingers crossed. The final announcement that I want to make is there will be room for a small number of questions at the end. And so, without more ado, can I invite Cedric Thornberry to deliver his third lecture on peacekeeping in the 90s and beyond. And keep your fingers crossed.
Director, thank you very much indeed. In my first lecture, you may remember, I tried to summarize the first 40 years of international peacekeeping, showing the main trends in its evolution. And on Thursday, I talked mostly about two of the major recent operations, that in Namibia and that in former Yugoslavia. In my final lecture, I shall look at some of the problems to which recent peacekeeping has been subject and make a few suggestions as to steps that could be taken to strengthen this process. Preliminarily, however, I should like to underline some of the trends that may be prevalent and some of the kinds of issue which future international action may have to address. I emphasize at the conclusion of my second lecture that peacekeeping and peace enforcement are two distinct phenomena and should not be confused. A further elemental point is that peacekeeping itself is but a mechanism for controlling or managing conflicts. It is not a policy, nor is it a substitute for decisions on policy issues. Even the provision of humanitarian relief with peacekeeping support can only rarely give an answer to an underlying issue, though it may afford the opportunity for such problems, political or developmental, to be resolved. In recent years, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has become the most significant international relief agency, along with the International Committee of the Red Cross, both working closely with UN peacekeeping operations in several countries. The International Committee of the Red Cross, of course, works within the limits of its own autonomous mandate. UNHCR now has an annual budget of $1.3 billion, derived almost entirely from voluntary contributions. Less than 20 countries, almost all from the Western world, provide more than 95% of those funds. In her most recent annual report, High Commissioner Sadako Ogata wrote that refugees are the symptoms of the ills of an age. Thus, in that year, 1993, 10,000 people a day throughout the world were becoming political refugees, not economic or other kind of migrants. You may be interested to know how these numbers have risen in the last 35 years. In 1960, UNHCR registered 1.4 million refugees throughout the world. By 1970, the number had risen to 2.5 million. In 1980, the number was 8.2 million. In 1989, the year of our brave new world's beginning, the proclaimed beginning of the New World Order, 14.9 million people had fled to other countries and been judged by the HCR to have a well-founded fear of persecution, the qualification for refugee status. In the last 5 years, another 8.1 million people have fled abroad. Thus, in 1994, the number of refugees stood at 23 million. At least the same number was estimated to be displaced, that is, had fled their homes but remained within their own countries. Thus, by last year, it's been calculated that about 1% of the world's population had been forced into flight by war or persecution. These are the chilling figures which manifest the symptoms of the ills of an age. The three areas with the largest rate of increase over the period from 1980 to 93 were, third, Africa, where the rise was from 3.7 million to 5.4 million, a rise of 46%. Second, Asia, from 2.3 to 7.2 million, 213% increase. And first, Europe, from 0.6 million to 3.6 million, an increase of 500% over the last 13 years. It seems that the amount which is now having to be devoted to relief is having a negative effect on developmental funds. Official development assistance from OECD countries to developing countries and related multilateral institutions fell in 92 to 93 by 7.8%, the overall percentage of development assistance dropping to 0.29%, the lowest figure since 1973. While new tasks are continuously being found for the UN, overall voluntary funding is declining. Such funding to UN funds and programs fell in 1993 by 11.5%. These include the World Food Program, the UN's Population Fund, United Nations Development Program, and UNICEF. UNICEF, an organization with a particularly good management reputation, which does outstanding work, saw a drop in its funding from 92 to 93 of 22%. At the same time, observers seem to agree that we have been living through what, in humanitarian terms, has been a catastrophic century. Since 1914, an estimated 187 million people have been killed or allowed to die by human decision in so-called megadeaths, more than ever before in history. Eric Hobsbawm calls it, without doubt, the most murderous century of which we have record, marking in many ways a return to what the 19th century would have called the standards of barbarism, with warfare directed against civilian populations, pogroms claiming millions rather than dozens of lives, and where torture in a recent dramatic reversal of the process of legal development over several centuries has become what he calls a normal part of the operations of public security in many modern states. One should also bear in mind, on the other hand, the pioneering of standards in the human rights field and their promulgation throughout the world, and billions have been freed from colonialism. But many of the trends which can be identified give little ground for optimism when approached from a humanitarian standpoint. Let me, while I am on the subject of figures, give one or two figures on peacekeeping and defense costs. United Nations peacekeeping in 1994 was what you might call the world's operational arm in many of its trouble spots. There were 17 operations ongoing. The overall budget of the United Nations in peacekeeping was about $3.5 billion. In that same year, the world's national defense budgets totaled about $900 billion. UN peacekeeping's cost was about 1/3 of 1% of this total. The overall defense expenditure in 1993 of four leading members of NATO, the US, UK, France, and Germany, was over $400 billion, more than 100 times the cost of the whole of UN peacekeeping. The development cost of the Eurofighter 2000 alone was $32 billion, nearly 10 times the cost of the 17 UN peacekeeping missions. The cost of one stealth bomber, as Sir Brian Urquhart unkindly pointed out, was greater than that of the whole of United Nations peacekeeping in 1992, a heavy year for the UN, with Cambodia, Yugoslavia, Angola, and many others starting up or continuing. All these disparities have their reasons. We are undoubtedly in a stage of acute transition, probably at the end of an epoch in international relations. There are cogent historic reasons. As that Russian general famously said to his NATO counterpart in 1989, "We are going to do something dreadful to you. We're going to take away your enemy." Yet at a time when the UN tends to be asked to do more and more with less and less, perspectives should be maintained. The fact is that peacekeeping operations are run on a shoestring, and military personnel coming from NATO forces, for example, to participate in the Bosnia-Herzegovina command of UNPROFOR in 1992 went visibly into shock when they experienced for the first time what the UN thought were reasonably ample logistical and support arrangements by UN standards. Rather, what member states thought were ample for the United Nations. There has not yet been, and it is a truism, an adaptation to the seismic changes which bipolarism concealed and repressed. No imperial disintegration has taken place without chaos, as political values undergo radical change and the center does not hold. Many of the current trouble spots, in fact, relate to the post-1945 decolonization. In 1993, as I've mentioned before, there were calculated to be 34 major wars in different parts of the world. All were internal conflicts. Such conflicts often have historical and ethnic roots. One estimate has it that there may be at least 2,000 self-conscious ethnic communities in the world. Are all entitled to the right of self-determination proclaimed by President Wilson and in the UN Charter and subsequent cardinal legal instruments? To say, therefore, that foreign policies and precepts are in confusion after the tectonic shifts that we have witnessed is not necessarily an accusation. Does anyone now know with certainty where to draw lines in the sand around the present borders of Croatia, of Bosnia, of so-called Serb Krajina, of Chechnya? Or is it, as I would contend, the defining issue of our age to find ways of ensuring that different ethnic or cultural groups may live harmoniously and securely together within the frontiers of a single state? The sources of instability, however, are not limited to ethnicity, though they often combine with them. Habitually, they also stem from social misery and grave economic injustice. The next century will surely present great challenges which can best be met through coordinated international action. There will be unprecedented pressures upon the world's environment as the whole community struggles to achieve sustainable development. The still mushrooming trade in arms and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction constitute a clear and present danger which has to be brought under effective international control. Gross and in some cases growing disparities in wealth and material conditions, combined with a still exploding world population, will, unless effectively confronted, induce more or less continual instability at regional and global levels. The desire of the many to better their lives may impel new torrents of mass migration, causing the fortunate few to build barriers and erect citadel states for protection against both economic migrants and political refugees. And we are already seeing that trend. As recent political disasters have shown, conflict and humanitarian deprivation could drive millions to seek sanctuary outside their homes, and UNHCR's figures showing logarithmic growth over the last 30 years are significant. Misery and repression provide fertile ground for extremist ideas and the rise of totalitarian leaders. Signals back from the future are already clear and decipherable. Perfecting international peacekeeping needs, I suggest, to be seen in the context of identifying the sources of conflict and instability and of seeking remedies. This is the strategy, in my opinion, which needs to accompany its adaptation as a technique for conflict control and management. Its reform cannot be conducted in a policy vacuum, and as I have said before, it is certainly not in itself a policy. But recent miscalculations have, as Australian Foreign Minister Gareth Evans has written, had a corrosive effect on the standing of the UN, and in particular of peacekeeping. Its public rehabilitation will need prudence and clarity of thinking. But, above all, it will need political will. Instead, at this time, peacekeeping is back on the drawing board, looking somewhat the worse for wear. Mainly, it has been a victim of hyperbole and of exaggerated public expectation and of inadequate governmental support. After a brief and sometimes triumphant flourish in some of the world's most difficult places, there are signs of the UN and of peacekeeping being marginalized once more. Last spring, The Economist came out with a savage cover cartoon. It showed a heap of bodies stretching into the distance, topped by a tattered UN flag at half-mast, planted in their midst. The caption read, "Shamed are the peacekeepers." The accompanying editorial, however, indicated that, for once, it wasn't us, the habitual scapegoats on the ground, who were to blame, but principally the Security Council. The Economist wrote that the world should by now have shed the illusion that it could achieve magically, without cost, what it wanted. The time had gone when the Security Council thought it could snap its fingers, rely on the UN's moral authority, and take cheap credit for its humanitarian resolve. In that vein, it wrote, it had declared areas of Bosnia to be safe for Muslims and had sent a handful of observers to Angola to verify that armies were demobilizing. In neither case were arrangements made to ensure that what it wanted to happen did happen. In both cases, its bluff was tragically called. The danger now, said The Economist, is that the Security Council's members, quote, their fingers burnt and their souls shamed, will draw the conclusion that the UN should try to do virtually nothing. The question, it concluded, is not whether to shut up shop. It is whether the permanent members of the Council are prepared to make the United Nations work more effectively by providing adequate support to its activities. In the late 80s, as I mentioned in my previous lectures, as global political change accelerated, the UN was presented with opportunities which far exceeded its former operational experience or resources. Its task moved on from being principally observation. Instead, it was itself actively to bring about peaceful change with the help of the Council and other regional bodies in accordance with a pre-agreed program. Its success caught the public imagination. But what was not well noticed was that a rare conjunction of factors had critically contributed to the success of a number of these operations, and that if the UN were to maintain such level of performance, far-reaching organizational, financial, and practical reforms were required with great urgency, not least in the Secretariat itself. There had, moreover, to be a better understanding of the strengths and weaknesses of peacekeeping if there were not to be a great anticlimax. Peacekeeping operations were founded upon principles, and practical common sense required that they be observed. What I call the principles of peacekeeping were not theological dogmas, as suggested by some critics. Instead, they reflected lessons learnt often the hard way in developing this evolutionary idea. In particular, they reflect the reality that the UN is composed of nations and that the consent of receiving states and contributor governments is necessary for a peace operation to succeed. Underlying this is an uncomfortable actuality which anyone still prepared to admit to a liberal philosophy must confront. This is that states find it easier to make commitments of troops and resources when direct national interests are involved than when their soldiers may have to fight and die for some abstract ism, however worthy. And this is one of the central paradoxes of peacekeeping. It requires that contributors be committed to the operation. Yet to have authority and legitimacy, a mission must be seen to be impartial and avoid itself becoming a part of the problem. The principles of peacekeeping are, I believe, these: that the consent of the parties and their continued cooperation are necessary, that the Security Council's mandate must be both clear and practicable, and that its support remain continuous and effective, that those deployed to the mission must fall under the exclusive authority of the Secretary General and the Security Council, that human and material resources made available to the mission must be adequate to the tasks and promptly deployed, that the mission must fulfill its mandate impartially between the parties, and that it must use minimum force. It should go without saying, that the success of any such mission also depends upon there being effective leadership, adequate managerial and coordinating structures, and competent personnel. Further, where a parallel peacemaking role is conducted by other negotiators, there must be the closest cooperation and coordination between them and the peacekeepers. In my personal experience, failure to comply with any of these rules may jeopardize the mission and imperil its members. Unfortunately, many, if not most, were disregarded or broken in regard to ex-Yugoslavia, Somalia, or Angola. Not all of these errors were the fault of the Security Council. During 1992 to 93, however, the Security Council, in creating new mandates, often invoked Chapter 7 of the Charter, frequently imposed resolutions without the consent or one or other of the parties, committed the peacekeeping operation to courses of action for which there was not the faintest chance that necessary resources would be forthcoming, and performed other diplomatic miracles and legerdemains. This tended for a time to appease national constituencies while shifting the onus to the Secretary General and those on the ground. But if governments do not give to a mission the resources needed to implement a Chapter 7 enforcement mandate, it is frankly worse than an empty gesture. It infuriates one side by taking sides with the other, then alienates the other when it is clear that there is no chance of the mandate being implemented. This was the repeated experience of UNPROFOR, first in Bosnia and then in Croatia, resulting in a steady erosion of our credibility and legitimacy and an assault on the mission's morale. During this sad period, the Council apparently neglected the expert advice and experience of the Peacekeeping Office of the Secretariat. The input of peacekeepers on the ground was sometimes not even sought. To my knowledge, leaders of three operations of this period have said that they learned subsequently that their assessments were not being conveyed to the Council, which they were told did not at that time wish to hear discordant views. Yet the Council must have been aware that enforcement action is a qualitatively different concept to peacekeeping. It means war and a capacity for force which bears no comparison to peacekeeping, and of course with a quite different deployment. As General Michael Rose has almost said, you don't go to war in compassionate white vehicles. The parties on the ground knew quite well, moreover, that the governments adopting such resolutions had not, in most instances, the slightest intention of making the commitment their resolutions entailed, of resources, casualties, even of political will. And the bombast of this euphoric period, I'm afraid, undermined our credibility on the ground, and the UN's image, briefly reburnished in the early 90s, has again been sadly tarnished. Meanwhile, the search continues for new roles for national armed forces and military alliances. NATO has been looking at possible support roles, and there has been some excellent cooperation with the UN. There has been talk of delegation by the UN to other regional alliances. In respect of Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Haiti, the Council, perceiving the UN's problems, has conferred wide enforcement mandates under Chapter 7 upon forces which sometimes have only remote command relationships with the Secretary General and itself, and reports circulate of informal agreements between governments legitimizing future spheres of influence and of intervention. This is, however one looks at it, a dangerous interim, and I know of no, or in any event, of very few simple answers. There will certainly be no magical overnight solutions. In a world awash with arms and with television beaming down on our homes appalling pictures of barbarity and suffering, however selectively, it seems to me that governments will have to be very clear just what they are willing both to do and what they will not do, so as to avoid political penalties for both action and inaction. I believe very much that governments, and I'm referring to governments now of the traditional peacekeeping contributor kind, should be informing their populations much more consistently about what peacekeeping is, what it entails, what the problems are, what the pros and cons are in regard to particular situations. But somehow this consciousness raising is not being engaged in, except in one or two of the, I think, the Nordic countries and one or two others that I have heard of. To some of the problems dumped on the UN, there's just no present solution. Often governments know this very well indeed. I wonder whether they should not perhaps steel themselves and say so a little more often. Let me conclude in the last 20 or 25 minutes with some thoughts on the strengthening of various specific aspects of peacekeeping. First of all, finance. I suppose once a director of administration, always a director of administration. How much do governments want to commit to peacekeeping? How serious are they about international peacekeeping? And post-Cold War, should our democracies not be looking for an even more substantial reallocation of priorities and resources from national defense budgets to UN operations? $3.5 billion, the approximate cost of UN peacekeeping last year, is of course a huge sum, but it paid for 17 operations involving more than 75,000 personnel in many of the world's worst trouble spots. One or two were rather unsuccessful. One or two were outstandingly successful. The majority were pretty successful. Comparatively speaking, the cost has been minuscule compared to that of modern armaments, Desert Storm, or national defense budgets. As I mentioned earlier, perhaps 1/3 of 1%, despite reductions consequent on the ending of the Cold War. Is there not a real question of proportionality here? I suspect the situation in many countries is still changing. But collective security and multilateralism are, after all, high on the nominal priority list of many states. And let me say it again, there can be no peacekeeping, and in the end, no United Nations, if governments do not pay their bills in full and on time each year. My second point is that there is a need for greatly enhanced coordination at high levels of management. The interface between Security Council and Secretariat, between Security Council and operations in the field, and between troop contributors and all of the above, is little documented, but it is crucial to confidence and effectiveness. It has shown signs of strain in the last couple of years. This is in part, perhaps, a product of rapid expansion. For until quite recently, the vital nexus between council and the other players was kept very close indeed. The complexity of multilateral operations demands the highest standards of coordination. This area is usually shrouded from view, bilateral consultations ordinarily being informal and private, and the council's consultations take place in camera. Sufficient communication of information and mutual confidence among the various elements should at all times be fully reinforced. For instance, visits by council ambassadors to field missions can be very useful indeed. My third point, I will make in a very perfunctory way, relates to the Secretariat. Despite some reforms that have taken place, further enhancement of the Secretariat could take place to make it a more operational body and one that provides better managerial support and control. There should be both administrative reforms, for example, major delegation to chief administrative officers in the field for recruitment, procurement, and so on purposes, and programmatic reforms, because there are some areas which are still very weak, such as mission planning, evaluation, and analysis, and in regard to public information and civil police. My fourth point is that there is need for a major new focus on preventive diplomacy and preventive peacekeeping. As already emphasized, peacekeeping itself is a mechanism. Making peace operations more effective means identifying the sources of conflict and instability and seeking remedies. The Charter sets out in Article 33, Paragraph 1, a well-known list of such devices. While it evidently contemplates interstate problems, some of these techniques could also be adapted to the kinds of situation which, upon their serious deterioration, have increasingly been coming to the UN. The lessons of the UN's successful but still very fragile operation in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia are well worth looking at. The use of third-party mediation or good offices in such matters is a very delicate business, and there are few precise rules or certainties. Nor is the UN necessarily the best organism to approach some of these matters. Regional bodies such as the OAU and the OSCE, as it now is, may have a particular role to play. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe has in recent years been especially active in Eastern Europe in peacemaking, conflict resolution, human rights and minorities questions. With a number of missions already in the field, it could evolve into a very useful body for preventive diplomacy. But these are early days, and there is still much uncertainty in Europe as to the respective roles of OSCE, the European Union, WEU, and NATO. I would suggest that no avenue should be dogmatically rejected at this time of great fluidity. What is vital, however, is that questions of causation receive more attention than heretofore by international bodies. Peacekeeping almost invariably deals with symptoms rather than the underlying sources of conflict and instability. To take another example, the human rights mechanisms of the Council of Europe have quite possibly made a significant contribution to the maintenance of stability in Western Europe since the coming into effect nearly 40 years ago of the European Convention on Human Rights. The fifth area that I want to look at briefly is the development of so-called regional arrangements. Chapter 8 of the Charter has in some respects been neglected during the UN's first 50 years. But this now seems to be changing. The UN has made use of some of NATO's capabilities in ex-Yugoslavia. One or two rather obscure arrangements have been made in some Russian hinterlands. ECOWAS is still bogged down in Liberia. And one gathers Britain and France are establishing a scheme to provide assistance to African countries which may be able to bring about regional peacekeeping arrangements. Article 52, paragraph 2 of the Charter is quite specific. It says that member states shall make every effort to achieve pacific settlement of local disputes through such regional arrangements or by such regional agencies before referring them to the Security Council. The Secretary General has long been a supporter of regional arrangements, but even he has recently warned that the world must take care that the new regionalism does not evolve as an alternative to multilateralism. Clearly, regionalism has both attractions and weaknesses. Neighborly knowledge and concern on the one hand, possible lack of impartiality on the other. And while the UN might well wish to develop and broaden its relationship with NATO as an enforcement agency, or a defensive aid to its forces if they get badly stuck somewhere, such involvement could also have its evident dangers, unless it or any similar body were truly responsible to the Council. If the NATO tail were to start trying to wag the UN dog, an example of which we saw recently over the BHATCH question, then the latter's future would be pretty bleak. One of the purposes of international peacekeeping has always been to uphold the international rule of law and to minimize the danger of the unilateral use of force in international relations. Delegation to other regional bodies can look an attractive option, but the evident peril is that it could provide a cloak for the neighborhood bully. The UN has been reluctant to use the forces of neighboring countries in its peacekeeping operations because they may lack the credibility of dispassionateness. It would emphatically not be a step forward in international relations if the Security Council were to make a practice of deputizing rich ranchers to run private posses. Yet the present reality is that the UN has not been provided with the resources to fulfill all possible tasks that are being brought to it. The Charter's draftsmen intended the greater use of regional bodies as agents of peacemaking, rather than that so many matters would come directly to the Council as it were, a court of first instance. And it has to be remembered that what the Charter was envisaging was the interstate dispute, not the kind of so-called internal problem we see so often today, and for which most regional arrangements are just not equipped, nor indeed is the UN. Thus, step by halting step, a range of expedients may have to come into being, and indeed are already doing so. A recently more wary Security Council may wish to look with care at proposed procedures and at all individual delegations of authority and instances of proposed regional peacekeeping activities so as to assure the effective role for itself envisaged by the Charter. My sixth point relates to UNCIVPOL, the United Nations Civilian Police. UNCIVPOL are in fact being used quite widely as human rights supervisors. I think the whole question of UNCIVPOL still needs a lot of attention. But successive operations since the reconception of the police in 1989 for the Namibia operation have shown that they can be a vital part of any operation which is a human rights, national reconciliation, or supervision of legal machinery aspect. Training and operational direction are important, and especially a background in what is, I believe, called neighborhood policing. This part of peacekeeping is not yet fully developed. Having de facto or de jure myself worn, inter alia, the chief of police hat in both Namibia and Yugoslavia, UNCIVPOL confirmed my sneaking suspicion that inside many a policeman there is a sort of civil rights lawyer struggling to be free. But the bottom line is, and I really don't want to offend any of my nice policemen friends, that proverb about poachers and gamekeepers. The seventh point that I want to make is that we often talk about standby forces in the context of peacekeeping. And that allusion is usually made in respect of military forces. But the point I want to make is a different one. Standby forces are just as necessary on the civilian side as on the military because of the developing nature of international peacekeeping operations. The last major operation the UN was able to staff with its own civilian resources was Namibia, though with the aid of external electoral specialists and supervisors. Since then, it has either recruited personnel or sought specialists on governmental secondment. In some cases, it has simply not been able to staff its missions, for example, Somalia. In Yugoslavia, UNPROFOR eventually managed to find personnel for all its posts. It took nearly 2 years. But only about 10% of its staff were from the UN system. It found many able people outside the UN. I recall that we staged a lightning nocturnal raid on this university at one point, actually, for young lawyers, very successfully, too. But it would have been much better and have enabled the mission to be fully operational much earlier had these professional staff had training in the sometimes esoteric but often necessary practices of the international civil service and in regard to peacekeeping, and had there been rosters of trained and possibly available personnel. In the very recent past, some governments, for example, those of Austria, Canada, and Sweden, perceiving this need, are now establishing training programs for civilian personnel for peacekeeping in such areas as the political, administrative, public information, logistical, legal, human rights, and humanitarian fields. The British military already have a well-developed program of peacekeeping training for officers from the UK and indeed other armed forces. The need on the civilian side is for training which is both academic and practical in UN and peacekeeping matters. One or two university institutions in the States also, I know, are starting to look at this possibility. But I wonder if Britain is not rather well placed to develop such training. I know that the University of Ulster is planning to participate with other bodies in Europe in this necessary field. My penultimate point, and 8, is that an effective public information program may be worth several battalions. The Secretary General's spokesman has recently recalled that UNTAG in Namibia was the first peace operation to develop a comprehensive public information program. It used all available techniques to inform the people about what the UN was doing in the country, about what would happen as the peace and democratization program went ahead, and to provide them with daily and authentic information on current events. It also proved important in countering false rumor and disinformation, which tend to be characteristic of, amongst others, undemocratic societies, and which were a destabilizing fact of life in southern Africa. It was important that the UN got its facts right, even when they were uncomfortable. The program also encompassed relations with the media, and UNTAG actively briefed the press on the record and on background bases as part of its overall approach. It tried to maximize transparency, and this may have helped it to survive its first desperate month, about which I spoke on Thursday, though this was obviously a risk. I am sure, however, that had we dissembled at that time, had we not told the plain, unvarnished, extremely uncomfortable truth, the media would probably have killed the operation in its first few weeks. I may say that this approach was not universally applauded at headquarters at the time. I think that perhaps once or twice they thought we had taken leave of our senses. But other missions have now taken public information a good bit further, especially the huge Cambodia operation and Yugoslavia, though there we've had some special problems. And it's no accident that Yasushi Akashi has been the Secretary General's special representative in both countries. He's given the approach a valuable push. Each mission has different problems, which it has to overcome by using different techniques. But the essence of all of them is that by keeping the local population informed, one reassures and builds confidence and makes what one does more widely understood and therefore acceptable. In Namibia, after a few months, the UN came to be seen as the main channel of objective information, though we had very slender resources. Even the South African administration followed UNTAG's daily presentations, and soon the South African press began printing daily the transcript of our little radio comment programs. It is vital that a UN information program be seen as being above the fray, and that it never be convicted of being disingenuous. It was distressing to read in a BBC World Service publication some months ago of the experience of its correspondent accredited to a certain United Nations operation. At the start of each daily briefing, the correspondent wrote, "Journalists would take bets as to the number of demonstrable untruths the poor spokesman would that day have been required to communicate to the world." Once it gets to that point, frankly, the mission is dead. Once the UN loses credibility, it loses its moral authority and its legitimacy, and these, I don't have to emphasize, are its residual foundations. Many of us have found that the UN has a lot to learn from the military about public information, though some of the less benign aspects of hearts and minds are unsuitable to UN operations. Let me just say, I'm not talking about the morality of truth or untruth. I'm talking about expediency, about the effectiveness of a policy approach. The military have long known that a good information policy, well executed, may be essential to a mission's strategic goals. A radio station enabling a mission to communicate directly with the people amongst whom it works may be worth more to the head of an operation than several battalion of infantry. Ninth and finally, I want to say a few words about the growth of humanitarian operations with military support. It's essential that such operations, and indeed all multi-component operations, be effectively coordinated. This unromantic word coordinated that I have used several times is certainly one of the least sexy words in the dictionary, but it is one of the key concepts to any multinational, multifunctional operation. Increasingly, peace support operations have a central core of humanitarian relief, and this is bringing the military and aid workers into increasing contact. The culture shock on both sides has at times been resounding. It often also has an intergenerational tone. One senior American general of my acquaintance had what was evidently an abrasive meeting with a senior relief manager who, however experienced, was in her late 20s. And the general came to me with his hands flapping, and he said almost incoherently, he said, "She talked at me just like my weirdo teenage daughter." UNHCR has grasped this problem and is in process of producing what I think are excellent booklets for the military and for their own staff, explaining to each what motivates the other and their individual processes and likely operational priorities. Both have come a long way in the last couple of years, but the level of mutual suspicion is still very high, especially where management is inexperienced or mediocre. UNHCR and the humanitarian non-governmental organizations in general are quite negative about the use of force in connection with humanitarian relief. It has never been used to gain access in Yugoslavia, though it has been used to help defend convoys. In Somalia, by contrast, force was used to gain access. High Commissioner for Refugees senior personnel believe that the impartiality of relief operations is compromised in such circumstances. For this reason also, they believe that humanitarian action must remain independent from UN-authorized military and political activities. The High Commissioner for Refugees provides relief on a basis of need only and has serious problems when the principle is disregarded by its partners, though it must be said that problems can arise in the practice of this wholly laudable and correct principle when you actually have to negotiate a convoy through. In Yugoslavia, UNPROFOR provides not only deterrent escorts, enabling HCR to bring relief where it would not otherwise have gone, it also provides logistical support, for instance, repairing, improving, building, and even demining roads and bridges, vehicle recovery, snow plowing, and all that sort of thing. My impression in Bosnia in particular was that cooperation between our military and the HCR was excellent. It's important that right from the start, the objectives and division of labor among the various components be clearly established. It's also encouraging to see the post-mission very sober analysis of Somalia that has been taking place among the U.S. military at high levels. A very self-critical, dispassionate analysis. Whatever may happen to peacekeeping generally, it seems virtually sure that combined humanitarian and military missions will go on being created, and this current work on maximizing the effectiveness of cooperation should have every support. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, in these three lectures I've sought to describe the origins of peacekeeping with UN military observers in the tawny hills of Palestine and Kashmir nearly 50 years ago. A little later, I related how thin blue lines of blue-helmeted soldiers kept enemies apart and settled local ceasefire disputes. As at the end of the 80s, international society fell into a new ferment, the device of peacekeeping was found to have the capacity for growth and adaptation to new ranges of situation in Central America and in the beautiful high desert country of the Kalahari. Often, these new roles were carried out in what had previously been regarded as essentially internal situations. But the device proved effective, provided its basic principles were observed. Thus, the UN was enlisted to make peace and effect peaceful change. Its costs remained comparatively slender, indeed minuscule, in comparison to those of the defense budgets of its members. However, widening roles, inflated mandates, and exaggerated public expectations contrasted with only modest levels of government support. Nor did change come about rapidly enough or radically enough in the Secretariat and in key processes of peace support management. It was sometimes overlooked that peacekeeping is a technique, not a substitute for substantive decision-making. But after the seismic political shifts of the late 80s, there were few certainties. Now, euphoria gone, a more realistic analysis of this important phenomenon should be made. There is a wide area, upon some of which I touched only an outline today. in which concerted action could bring about vast improvement. Meanwhile, there are occasional signs that UN peace operations could be bypassed, as some cast around for other means of dealing with questions of international peace and security. Alas, one hears it said, the UN just doesn't have enough resources to play its designated role. But, Mr. Chairman, this is neither logical nor even elegant, for it is for governments to ensure the adequacy of UN resources and competence. And frankly, it ill behoves debtors who do not pay their bills to remark on how haggard and hungry their creditors are looking. Yet the increased use of regional processes could be beneficial at a time when all appropriate resources need to be utilized, and Chapter 8 of the Charter has never been made fully effective. But regionalism, as the Secretary General has warned, should not be permitted to evolve into an alternative to multilateralism. The range and dimension of problems we can dimly see, some of which I tried to sketch earlier today, as we peer into the future, underline the importance of control or management on a global scale. In the end, it is for governments to decide what kind of UN they want. An effective international body, or one that is shoddy, inept, and hobbling. And of course, the solution to the many problems of peacekeeping is not fundamentally military, nor financial, nor technical. It is one of political priority. That said, it is for the peoples of the United Nations, the peoples of the United Nations, to tell their governments what to decide. For, let us recall, it was in their name, our name, that 50 years ago this year, the Charter was promulgated.
As I said, we have time for just a few questions, if there are any from the audience. Yes.
Okay, let me take Croatia first. Perhaps I'll just focus on Croatia. The UN hasn't been able to implement the mandate, the original mandate of SCR 743 in a number of important ways in Croatia. In particular, it hasn't been able to achieve the national reconciliation concept by returning refugees, by reintegrating local councils and all that sort of thing. I'm not sure we would have been able to do that even if there hadn't been the Croatian incursions of, when were they, January and September 93, but they certainly put the lid on it. That was one problem, and we should be perfectly frank, we have not been able to do that, because we haven't had, never mind why, but we haven't. But then the Council gave the UN additional mandates in regard to Croatia. And in regard to some of those mandates, it consulted perhaps the Croatian representative in New York. It didn't consult, certainly didn't consult people on the ground who were going to have to do the job. And what it did was to give a mandate which was certainly well-intentioned. The idea was to expedite the process of national reconciliation, that sort of thing. But the fact is that if you don't consult both sides and if you don't get them both on board, the only way we can do that is by persuasion or force. Persuasion had already failed. The council certainly wasn't going to use a Chapter 7 enforcement operation in Croatia. And the Croats, Croatians, were pretty indignant with us because we failed to implement what the council said. And the Serbs were fit to be tied because they said, well, the UN is no longer impartial. It's taken the side of the Croats. This is the kind of problem that I had in mind.
Yes, the back. While you're thinking, could you hear the question at the back there? Right.
I'm afraid this is a question which I would like to devote an hour for an answer. Some elements of the media certainly had their own agenda in Yugoslavia. No question, and they made, on a personal basis, little secret of their intentions, of their desire and their intentions and what they were setting out to do. They were setting out to bring about Western military intervention. And I'm afraid that some of their professionalism was subordinated to those certain objectives. I'm not speaking of any British journalists, but there were one or two others whom I have in mind and whom I knew quite well, and I understood what they were doing, but really wondered whether this was the role they should be fulfilling. The big problem with print journalism is television. Of course, it is enormously impacted upon by the high-tech capability of satellite transmission and reception, and the length of the soundbite, and the fact that boom boom, you know, is better, is more likely to be good in terms of ratings than boom boom, and you know, our correspondent will now explain to you why this situation has been developing since the 15th century and so on. I mean forget it. You lose the audience, you lose the story. And there's been a lot of, I'm sure, I don't know whether you're a journalist yourself, but there has been a lot of self-critical analysis by journalists in the last few years, which I have found very, very impressive, talking about this particular problem and how to overcome it. So, yes, the basic difficulty is peacekeeping almost always requires explanation. And short, staccato television doesn't allow for explanation. Essentially, it's geared to the dramatic image of the moment, I think. But that's a terribly oversimplified response.
Yes.
Do you think that the extent of the Council of Europe machinery or individual petition in Eastern Europe will have any real effect in resolving the essentially communal and ethnic disputes there?
What a good question. Sir, you may be aware, you may recall the importance of the language cases in regard to Belgium, which related to the intercommunal difficulties there. And I think it was during the 60s, wasn't it, that there was a series of those cases. And I think many people felt that the procedure of the European Commission and the European Court provided a very, very useful safety valve, a way of calming a situation, of detaching it from the street to the courtroom, as it were. I don't know the answer to your question. I think it probably has more chance than the use of an interstate mechanism. I'm afraid that almost always sets up a confrontational political situation. And I would have thought by now that the machinery of the Council of Europe, which is very experienced indeed now, will probably know how to handle these situations and to diffuse them. I say that as a matter of hope, possibly also a little bit of previous experience.
We have time just for one more. It's the lady in the back there.
Well, I think practical steps are being essayed at the moment. I have to agree with what you say, madam. Again, it was my former mentor, Brian Urquhart, who made the sardonic comment that it just so happens that the five permanent members of the Security Council are also the world's five largest arms exporters. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we really have been enormously privileged over these last three evenings when we've heard Cedric Thornbury share with us not only his experiences, but his thoughts and reflections on those experiences. There can be few, I think, who have had his range, both of peacekeeping and peacemaking, of administration, of legal, political, and indeed informational roles in the United Nations system. And I also think there can be few former teachers of the London School of Economics who have gone out so bravely and so diligently to put into practice some of those things which they taught and learnt whilst here. Of course, much of what we've learnt is sobering and could even be held depressing. But I must say I find myself at the end of this series actually rather encouraged on a totally trivial level. Cedric and I talked over tea about worst-case scenario planning. I accused him of being a worst-case merchant, and I said, what happens if your voice fails? Well, it didn't, so there's a worst case that hasn't arisen. And there must have been a number of worst cases that haven't arisen. I always find it somewhat comforting to think that however bad things are, you can always imagine something worse. On the positive side, I also think that although the United Nations is not without criticism, and gosh, we've heard some criticisms of it this evening, and indeed in the previous couple of lectures. But I think it's actually remarkable what can be achieved on 1/3 of 1% of the defence budgets. I mean, one natural thought that I had when I heard that astonishing figure was what could be achieved by 2/3 of 1% of the defence budgets, and that is still, of course, a trivial sum of money compared to what we all contribute in the West to defence. So I think it's a very hopeful message we've learnt. There's a lot that can be improved. We know what it is. It is, at the end, as Cedric Thornbury so rightly said, a matter of political will. So on your behalf, I would like to thank him for a truly fascinating series of lectures, and I hope that we will go away from this lecture theatre tonight and try and help him do better.